Now, let's open in our Bibles to Esther chapter 3. Tonight, we're going to try to cover chapter 3. We have a schedule so that we finish the book in these 5 days. And if we do chapter 3 tonight, we're right on schedule. Tomorrow night will be chapters 4 and 5. So we'd love you to read ahead, keep ahead of us in your reading. We might get a little further tonight, but we'll see how it goes. Esther chapter 3. Don't forget to feel free to ask questions or raise your hand as we study. Did real well on the quiz. I'm encouraged. I went away last night thinking no one got anything out of it. So you got something. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, did Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. The king promoted this man. That means he made him great. He made him the first man under him. We'd call him a prime minister or something of that sort. Haman. Now, as we begin chapter 3, we're beginning to see the working of the evil one as Satan works behind the scenes. As Satan moves in mysterious ways and works through his instruments. Here is one of his chief instruments of that day, this man Haman, who was promoted, who was advanced, who was made great in the kingdom. Satan's able to get his men in high places. We saw last night God was able to get his woman, his choice, in a high place. And God allows Satan's choices to be put in high places. Of course, anything Satan does, he always has to get permission from the King of Kings. He can't do anything unless God allows it. Now, look in chapter 3, verse 10. And Haman is there described as what? At the very end. Right, the enemy of the Jews. Turn over to chapter 7, another description of this man. Chapter 7 and verse 6. How did Esther herself describe this man? The enemy, and what else? A wicked man, and what else? Adversary. Now, put your piece of paper in Esther, or however you want to hold your place there. I'd like to show you two verses. Now, don't forget, Haman was called the enemy and the adversary. Look in Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. And verse 39. Matthew 13, that's the first gospel in the New Testament, Matthew 13, verse 39. The enemy is who? The devil. Now, keep that in mind. Go to 1 Peter chapter 5. That's near the end of the New Testament. 1 Peter, after the book of Hebrews, after James, you come to 1 Peter. Near the end of the Bible. 1 Peter chapter 5. Do you find a verse that talks about the adversary? Yes, Harold. Verse what? Verse 8. And who is your adversary? The devil. Your enemy, your adversary, the one who's opposed to God and to all that stands for God and God's people. And by the way, the name Satan means adversary. That's what the name Satan means. the adversary, the enemy. Now Haman, as we've seen, he was a wicked enemy, he was a wicked adversary, and yet behind him there was an even greater person, there was an even greater enemy, an even greater adversary. And you see, as we study this book, we have to learn to look behind these people and see who the real person is working behind, even though he's not mentioned in this book. That's why the very first question I asked was, who are the two main characters of this book? God and Satan. We have to see who's working out his evil plan, even though you can't quite see him. He's invisible, he's unseen, he's unmentioned, but he's there. Okay, let's go back now to Esther. Right before Job, I need to put a piece of paper in mine. Esther chapter 3. And verse 2. Before we go there, notice at the end of verse 1 that he was given a seat or a throne above all the other princes. He was the number one man apart from the king. So he'd be the number two man in throughout the whole Persian Empire. This man was regarded as number two. Now that's pretty high exaltation, wouldn't you say? In fact, you can't go much higher. I'm sure he didn't expect to go above the king. And probably that was his greatest ambition, to be the number two man. You can't go much higher than that. Now, when a person is exalted very high, then there's really only one way he can go after that, right? When you're at the top of the Ferris wheel, what's the only way you can go? Right. You have to go down. From there on out, it's down all the way. When you're at the top floor, the elevator's going all the way up. The next time that elevator moves, you can be sure it's going down. Right? That's the way it goes. And as we're going to see, Haman, this is the farthest up he's going to get. And when we're done with this fella, look in chapter 7, verse 10. This is a preview of coming events. Chapter 7, verse 10, how far down does he get? Do you see it? How far? From the throne, number two man, to the gallows. What a sad history of the very opposite of exaltation. Now, it's going to be interesting to see how God brings this man down. It's almost comical. As we get into this, we'll probably have some good laughs. So we see God working to bring this man down. It's unbelievable how he falls down. Yes? Right. Right. This man was one of the biggest egos in the Old Testament, this Haman. And you see the ego of Satan right behind him. I will be as the Most High God, Satan desired. The pride of Satan is seen in Haman. And just like Satan wanted to go up, he ended going down. So it is... what you see happening to this man is a very good parallel, or like you said, an allegory, of Satan's career. Like we studied last at the quiz on Revelation, the three downfalls of Satan, down to the earth, down to the bottomless pit, down to the lake of fire. We're going to see the different downfalls of Haman, all the way down to the gallows. So it's a very instructive lesson. As a believer, if you want to go up, what's the way up? Go down? I have to go down if I want to go up? Doesn't make sense. You mean if I want to go up to the balcony, you tell me to go down the basement steps? See? That's God's. God says, let's look for a minute. Put your paper in, Esther. Look in James. That's near the end of the New Testament, again, right after Hebrews, right before 1 Peter, where we were before. James chapter 5. James chapter 4. Can you find a verse in James chapter 4 that tells us how to get lifted up? How are we going to go up? Verse 10. Why don't you read that for us, Rupert? Right. There's the way up. Humble yourself. Let God push you down under His mighty hand. And what will He do? He'll exalt you. He'll lift you up at His right time. He'll make you great, but He'll do that. Don't make yourself great. That won't work. He'll have to do that. And the king, Ahasuerus, he's the one who made Haman great. And yet, how does the believer become great? What's the secret of greatness? Look in Matthew 23, the first gospel, Matthew chapter 23. The Lord Jesus told us how to become great. Matthew chapter 23. That's a good verse. Why don't you read that for us? Good. Now, let's read the next verse also. Matthew 23, verse 12. And whosoever shall exalt himself like Haman shall be abased, shall be brought and made low. And he that shall humble himself like the humble believer shall be what? Exalted. Shall be made great. That's the secret of greatness. Now, you know, the Bible says that there was a man who was great in the sight of the Lord. Do you know who that man was? John. John the Baptist is what I don't know if it says that about Job or not. But John the Baptist, it says he was great in the sight of the Lord. What's the secret to being great? Being humble. Now, here's something interesting I learned just yesterday, and I was taught it from the primary class, their lesson yesterday, the first, second, third graders. You know what they learned about John the Baptist? Remember he said, I am not even worthy to do what? To unlatch the Lord's sandal. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. If you were a disciple, if you were a disciple under a teacher, you would be willing to do anything for that teacher. You'd go an extra mile for him. You'd pick up his shirt. You'd do anything for him, except there was one thing that a disciple refused to do, even for his teacher. What do you think it was? To unlatch his sandals. He wouldn't do that. He'd do anything else. Now, this is according to Jewish writings, rabbinical writings. They said that. Now, if you were a slave, you would be willing to do anything for your master, even what? You'd even unlatch his sandals. What did John the Baptist say? I'm not even worthy to do that. I'm not even worthy to be his slave. Isn't that great? Now, there was a humble man. I'm not even worthy to be his lowly slave. And yet God said, that man is great in the sight of the Lord. And of those born of women, there was none greater than John the Baptist. That's what Jesus said about that man. So I hope we raise up some people that are great in his sight. Okay, let's go back to Esther, chapter 3. And verse 2. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate, now look what they did as this wicked Haman passed by. Two things. What were they? They bowed and they reverenced him. A mere man. Now why did they do it? Right, the king had so commanded concerning him. I'm sure that pleased Haman. I'm sure he was delighted by that. I'm sure he loved it. He wanted that worship. After all, you know, if you're the greatest person around, don't you want people to realize that too? Don't you want people to acknowledge that fact? Sure you do. You know, no one wants to celebrate it by themselves. They want everyone else to recognize their greatness. So Mr. Ego here, everyone bows down. And that just delighted this man. But there's one thing that spoiled it. Just one thing that ruined the whole day for this man. It didn't matter if 50 million people bowed down and reverenced him. There's one spoiler that wrecked the whole thing. Who wrecked it? Mordecai. He bowed not, nor did him reverence. Verse 3. Then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, why? Why did you break the king's commandment? Why didn't you bow down? Now, the interesting thing is, there's no recorded answer. So as we study the book of Esther, we kind of have to think what he may have answered the king. And if you look in verse 4, what was part of his answer? He made known the fact that he was a Jew. So we know that much, that if that was a secret before, it wasn't a secret now. He told them clearly he was a Jew. And you know, Jews were careful about who they bowed down before. They were careful about who they reverenced. There was once a time when the greater than Haman said to the Lord Jesus, will you bow down and worship me? What did the Lord answer? Remember the great temptation? Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. And he continually refused to bow down to this man. Now, behind Haman, like we just shared, is the greater than Haman. And what is the one thing that Satan really wants? Honor and worship, doesn't he? There's coming a future day. We call this the Great Tribulation, the great time of trouble and tribulation on the earth. And once again, Satan will have an instrument on this earth. He'll have a man to accomplish his purposes. And if you look, put your piece of paper in there again. If you look in Revelation 13, the last book of the Bible, Revelation chapter 13. Can can you find any place in this chapter that shows us Satan's desire to be worshipped, even if that worship comes through his instrument? Revelation 13, verse 8. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him. This is talking about the beast, the man of sin, the Antichrist, whatever you want to call him, who will someday be worshipped. A mere man being worshipped as if he was God. Any other verses in there? What happens, this Antichrist, if people refuse to worship him, if they refuse to bow down, if they refuse to take the mark, he gets so angry. What's he want to do? Where do you see that? Verse 15. Want to read that loud and clear, Gary? Okay. Anyone that doesn't worship will be caused to be killed. Because this man will be so proud, so self-centered, so desirous of worship, thinking he's so great, that he'll demand worship and he'll kill those that refuse to meet that demand. Now, isn't that so similar to Haman? Let's go back. Let's see how Haman reacted. For those of you that weren't here last night, we take about an hour of the first session. We go to about 8:15, and then we have a refreshment break, and then we take a final half hour from 8:30 to 9. So we have some more minutes to keep going. Chapter 3. And verse 5. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, he said, "Oh, well, most people are doing it. That's enough for me." He was, what? Full of wrath. If you think today and yesterday was hot, you should have seen this man. Probably fire was coming out of his mouth. He was hot. He was in a rage. He was so angry against this man. Remember what the man of sin is going to do? If they don't worship, what is he going to do? Kill. Verse 6. He not only was going to grab Mordecai and kill him, but what else? But that wasn't enough. He wouldn't be satisfied just with that one man. But he would lay hands on the people of Mordecai. Did he know whose Mordecai people, who they were? Yeah, he knew that Mordecai was a Jew. For the word had gotten around that this fellow's a Jew. And he was out to destroy the whole nation because of what this one man had done. But don't you see that behind this man there's a force, there's a person who hates God, who hates what God stands for, who hates the people of God, and who's out to destroy God's people. You know, one of the reasons is because out of God's people, who's going to come? Right. The Lord Jesus Christ was promised that he would be born out of the Jewish people, out of the tribe of Judah, out of the seed of David. And one way to get rid of him or prevent him from coming is to very simply get rid of them all. And here was a satanic attempt to exterminate the people of God. And you have to look beyond men as you read your Bible. As you see Herod the Great wiping out the babies of Bethlehem? You have to look beyond that wicked man. You have to realize there's a person behind with a vicious hatred for God and for God's people, and most of all, for God's anointed Messiah. So verse 6, he was going to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai. Now it's interesting, what's one thing that Haman didn't realize about these Jews that he wanted to wipe out? He knew that Haman was a Jew, but what didn't he realize? Right, he didn't realize that the queen herself was a Jew. And I'll tell you this, when he finds out, he's going to be one shocked man. It's going to come at the most inconvenient time when he discovers that the queen's a Jew. But she's going to kind of keep the secret a little longer until just the right time, then he'll find out. Verse 7. How's he going to wipe out the Jews? How's he going to destroy them? In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur. Remember we talked about Purim? Well, the word Pur means what? Lot. It's just another word for lot. They cast lots before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now let me explain what this is talking about. Haman wanted to choose the day of destruction for the Jews. And being a very superstitious man, he thought that the method I'll use to select the right day to destroy the Jews will be by casting lots. That was a method of the ancient world whereby they would find out which day to do things and so forth. So they when he did this, it was the first month of the year. It was the first month of the year. And they cast lots, and they wanted to find out what day should be chosen to exterminate the Jews, to kill them, to have them killed. Now, the closest thing I thought of that we have today, we don't cast lots. What do we cast? Dice. Okay, I had someone bring me some dice tonight. Now, let's suppose that I'm Haman. And you're my wicked advisors. Okay? And we have to determine the very day in which the Jews are going to be destroyed. So what do? We say, okay, our gods are going to help us determine the right day. We have our lots. We have our dice. Oh, God, show us the right day. Now, they start throwing lots. Let's see. Today is July 22nd. Now, here's what we'll do, advisors. See if this sounds good to you. We'll say that the day upon which two sixes appear, double six, that will be the day of destruction. Okay? So we start throwing the dice. Six and a four. Sorry, it's not going to be the 22nd. Let's see if it'll be the 23rd of July. I don't believe it. I got two sixes. I was trying this for about, earlier, and I didn't get two sixes. I must have thrown it 30 times. So the day would be July 23rd. The day after tomorrow, they're going to all be destroyed. That was amazing. Six and a three, five and a four, six and a four. Probably couldn't do it again. Six and a two. But you see, they kept going on the calendar. They kept going until the right combination or whatever it was came up. And one month passed, and They kept throwing, and it wasn't the next month, it wasn't the next month, it wasn't the next month, it wasn't, it kept going on. And what did it land on? Verse 7. The 12th month. In other words, about 11 months later. Now, I did, and I got one day later. They were probably wondering, now, why isn't it falling right? This is a long process. Couldn't they be destroyed a little earlier? But if the gods so say, we'll keep throwing. But about 11 months later, if you want the precise day, you have to go to verse 13. And the letters were sent by post unto all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women. And in one day, this is the day of destruction, even upon the 13th day, that's an unlucky day, isn't it? Of the 12th month, I wonder if it was Friday, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. The 13th day of the 12th month. And in verse 7, the day on which they decided this was the first month. It doesn't say what day, but it was somewhere in the first month that they cast lots. Now, here's the interesting thing about this whole thing. You know, men may cast lots and men may throw dice, but look in Proverbs chapter 16. Proverbs chapter 16. Let's find out who's in charge of the dice. And I know you're thinking, maybe, it's pure luck. You know, the God of chance is in charge of the fall of the dice. The God of randomness. Well, Proverbs 16, verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap. Men may throw lots and men may cast dice, but who's in charge of how they fall? The Lord. The whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. God overrides and overrules, and he lets men pick up their dice and he lets men throw it. But our God is so great that he overrules and overrides even the smallest details. Now, that doesn't mean you go home and you get out your Monopoly board and pray to God and say, Lord, you're able to help me win this game. I'll throw the dice and you make it fall just right for my own advantage. But you see, God was over this in the days of Haman. God was in charge. God was working, even in the throwing of the dice, even in the casting of the lots. And God worked it out so perfectly so that there would be plenty of time for Haman's plan to be foiled and to come to nothing. God allowed plenty of time for things to be worked out. And we're going to see it was a very difficult problem. We're going to see that the Jews were up against an irrevocable decree that could not be changed. It was a very difficult problem. And yet God allowed time for things to work out. Now, Haman was convinced that on the 13th day of the 12th month, what would happen? Right, the Jews would be wiped out. I'm sure if you asked him, he'd say, definitely, that's going to happen. No question about it. We've determined it. We're going to work it out with the king. We're going to have a decree made. It's all going to be taken care of. You know, the interesting thing is that that man never lived to see that day. Haman never lived to see the 12th month. He never lived. The Jews lived. They lived to see it. They lived to celebrate on that day. But Haman never lived to see it, as we're going to see. Okay, back to Esther, chapter 3. Verse 8. Now Haman, he's determined the day of destruction. Now he has to work it out with the king. Verse 8. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws, therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them or to allow them to live. Now, he said some things there that weren't true. I'm sure the Jewish people were, for the most part, subject to the king. And yet, do you see a pretty good testimony for the Jewish people there in what he said? Sounds pretty good to me, doesn't it to you? What stands out there about the Jews? They were different. They were marked as a special people, a peculiar people. They had a difference about them. They had unique laws that they followed, God's laws. And they were, you could notice them. They didn't just mix in with the people and become assimilated so that there was no difference. That's the amazing thing about the Jews down through history, that even though they were often scattered among the heathen, they always remained separate so that you could always distinguish them as Jews. As they were cast in among the Persians, they didn't become Persians. They were Jews among the Persians. And as they're thrown into Russia, they don't become Russians, they are Jews among the Russians. And they're Jews among the Americans. And they always maintain their identity. And other ancient people just didn't do that. I mean, how many Babylonians do you find in New York City? You know, I'm a Babylonian. I'm an Egyptian. You don't find that. But you find millions of Jews in New York City that have remained distinct and separate and different. They don't just mix in. They're kind of like water and oil. They stay separate. Now, you know, God tells us that He doesn't want us to mix in with the world so that they can't tell a difference. Can you think of a verse that tells us we're not to do that? Second. Okay, right. Be separate. Okay. And can you think of another verse? We're not to be... I couldn't hear. Okay, not to be unequally yoked. That's from that same passage. Right. There's a good one. Not to be conformed to this world. Not to let this world press you into its mold so that there's no difference. And that's so important that we show forth a real distinction. And that difference, of course, is Christ. Okay. Verse 9. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. It's interesting, he doesn't even tell the king who these people are. He doesn't even say these are the Jews. And what's even more interesting is the king says, okay, let's do it, without even finding out who they are. You'd think he'd put a little thought into this, a decree that's going to wipe out a whole people. You'd think he'd think through it a little bit. Yet how often do we go and do things and later wish we had thought about it first? Well, if it please the king, verse 9, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver. Silver's worth a lot, isn't it? And a talent was pretty heavy. I think some talents were up to 100 pounds. 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. How would he get so much money? Right. Look at the end of verse 13. To take the spoil of them for a prey. Now the Jews had an amazing knack of wherever they went, of succeeding business-wise and financially, and wherever they go, whatever kingdom they are, they seem to do well. They seem to prosper. They seem to be blessed materially. You don't see too many poor Jews, do you? And so what Haman was thinking here, when we kill the Jews, we can just help ourselves to all their possessions, all their silver, all their wealth, which will be left behind. And then verse 10, and the king took his ring from his hand and gave it unto Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jew's enemy. In other words, the king took off his ring, a very special ring. This was called a signet ring. It was a ring that was like a seal. It was an official seal. Whenever there was an official document, to make it official, it had to be sealed with the king's official seal, his official signet ring. And that would be just like his signature. That would be the official stamp upon that document. Yeah, same type of thing. To make it official, just like some legal documents have to be done today. And he gave Haman the ring, which was like saying, Haman, you go ahead, you can write up the decree, put it in your own language, make it say whatever you want it to say, and then you have my permission. Oh, thank you. We're not. Okay, we're not ready, but we will be in a few seconds. He can't, what was I saying? We're not ready. Pardon? Right, the signet ring, and that made it official, and Haman was given complete authority to write up the document, write up the decree, according to his own wishes, and then it would be sent forth. And once it was sealed, it was official, it could never be what? Never be changed. Now, things aren't looking too good for the Jews. And as Walter Cronkite gets on TV that night, he says, there is a major, major victory for Satan, because God's people are doomed. The day has been determined. The document has been sealed. There's no hope. But he forgot one thing. There's a God in heaven who's on the throne. Okay, chapter 3, and let's go to verse 11. And the king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, and the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee. So Haman actually got a green light to just go ahead and do just what seemed good in his eyes, to carry out his wicked plans and to write up this decree to destroy the Jews. Verse 12. Then were the king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month. See, we're still in the first month when this decree is being written. And there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants and governors that were over every province, and to the rulers of every people of every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written. It had his authority behind it. It was sealed with his seal. It says, and sealed with the king's signet ring. So Haman just went ahead and did what he wanted to do. Verse 13. And the letters were sent by posts. Now, what would we say today? Postmen. And they were sent by postmen unto all the king's provinces. Now, the Persian postal system was really quite remarkable and very efficient. I wish we could hire these Persians to come and take over. And I think they do better with their horses than we do with our horsepowers. But I'd like to read something that the ancient historian Herodotus once said about these Persian postmen. I'll read it. And don't forget, we're going to make available to you notes on the book of Esther that we have. And there'll be a sign-up sheet later in the week. So if you don't take notes as well as you'd like, or if you'd rather just not take notes and listen, the notes that you'll get are more detailed than what I'm giving you. So everything should be there. And this quote is included in the notes. Nothing mortal travels so fast as these Persian messengers. Along the whole line of road there are men stationed with horses, in number equal to the number of days which the journey takes, allowing a man and a horse to each day. And these men will not be hindered from accomplishing at their best speed the distance which they have to go, either by snow or rain or heat or by the darkness of night. Who used to say that? Someone? Pony Express. This was the first Pony Express, dedicated, whether it snowed or rained or heat. The first rider delivers his dispatch to the second, and the second passes it to the third, and so it is borne from hand to hand along the whole line. And they, in fact, it was so efficient that in a few weeks, the most remote parts of the empire could be reached with the message. Now, that's pretty good for the ancient world. Remember how far the empire extended? From India to Ethiopia, Africa, we saw in chapter 1. So that's what it means by posts. Literally, the word means runners. And they didn't literally run, but they ran and jumped on their horses and off they went. They were delivered, verse 13, by posts into all the king's provinces. And here's what the decree said: to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish. Now, Haman uses these three words. Remember, he authored this decree. He uses these three words. We're going to come across these three words again and again in other verses. But these three words: to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish. I guess he figured if they didn't quite get the first word, he'd make it crystal clear. He used three words that you got to get the point by the time you read all three, and no one would ever wonder what the intent of this decree was. To destroy, what's that mean? It means to kill. I'm still not sure I got it right. It means to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old. Little 5-year-old guy, little 10-year-old guy. Haman's hatred was so bitter against these people, and Satan behind him, little children and women, and how long would it take? One day, the day of destruction, the day that was already determined by Lot. Even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. Not only kill them, but help yourself to the loot. Verse 14. The copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people that they should be ready against that day. In other words, this decree went forth throughout all the empire so that all the Jews' enemies would be ready to do that work of destruction on that day. Verse 15, the postmen went out, being hastened by the king's commandment. And the decree was given in Shushan, the palace, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. This king seemed to have a favorite pastime. He sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Now, the word went forth. The decree went out. And we're reminded once again that the laws of the Medes and the Persians could not be changed. Could not be changed. And I'm sure that Haman must have really been rejoicing in his heart. He must have thought, there's no way that my plan can be thwarted. There's no way that this can be stopped now, because it's in law, it's been sealed, and the message has been sent. They're already on their horses. They're already reaching people with the message. The people in the capital city have already gotten the news. And the horses are going forth to all the other parts of the empire. The decree is set, and it cannot be changed. He must have really thought this plan was going to be accomplished. But Haman had to learn one thing. Haman was not sovereign, right? Haman could not be guaranteed that his plans would be accomplished because he wasn't the number one person who was in control. And even though the laws of the Medes and Persians were fixed and unchangeable and irrevocable, there's another law that's even greater. There's another plan that's even higher. And I'd like to share what that is. Isaiah chapter 46, the book of Isaiah. Chapter 46. Right before Jeremiah and Ezekiel, right before those books, Isaiah. A little bit after Psalms. Chapter 46. Verse 10. This is God speaking. Verse 10. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, now notice this, my counsel will what? Will stand. The New Testament says that God works all things according to the counsel of His will. No one gets in the way of that. No one blocks that. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11. No one can hinder that. And it says, verse 10, I will do all my pleasure. God says, whatever pleases me, I'm going to do. Whatever delights me, I'm going to do. Whatever my will is, I'm going to accomplish it. You say, well, that's selfish. God is the only one that has a right to be selfish, right? And that's a holy selfishness. He has a right to be number one and to have a plan that's going to be fulfilled. Did someone have a question? Okay, that's a good question. In other words, the question is, how well can Satan predict the future? Satan is not omniscient. He's not all-knowing. God alone is. He's a finite creature. Now, one of the ways to answer that is just take a look at Satan's prophets. Take a look at Satan's false prophets. Take a look at Gene Dixon's and I don't know who the other characters are. And take a look at their predictions. Now, some of their predictions are amazingly fulfilled. And I think it was spectacular that this woman predicted the assassination of President Kennedy in an amazing way. And yet, you read of many of her other predictions, and I'm sure she's wrong far more than she's right. Now, we have to ask the question, well, how is she able to be right sometimes and even in remarkable manners, in a remarkable way? Well, here's one suggestion. Satan is a spiritual creature. He has access through his demons and so forth to a lot of information. For example, he had access to Lee Harvey Oswald. In other words, Satan could, as it were, spy out this man and somehow listen in as he talked with others. Maybe he talked with someone about what he was intending to do. Maybe he had some written documents about a diary or something, or whatever it is. Satan gets around. He's able to gather information, and some things he's able to learn. And he could have passed that information on to people like Gene Dixon that are open to that kind of thing. That's just a suggestion. Danny? He's what? Yeah. Right. In other words, Danny's taking it a step further. Not only can he gather information, but he can even influence his children, his spiritual children, through the mind, through thoughts, through their own sins. And he was certainly working probably in Lee Harvey Oswald as an example. Gary. Yeah. 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 Yeah, he seems kind of stupid, doesn't he, sometimes? Doesn't sin make us stupid? No. That he really thought somehow he could defeat God. And he never seemed to give up. Diane? Right. Right. Okay, that's a good thought. Anyone else? Okay. Okay, these are good thoughts. Okay. Okay, that's certainly true. Sin really blinds the mind, even of Satan. And these are all good thoughts. Okay, let's go back to, let's get away from Satan for a minute. And he's just the second character of this book. The main character is the Lord. Okay, now we're in verse 11. Are we still in Isaiah 46? Verse 11, calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, and what God plans and purposes, is it going to be accomplished? I will do it. And that decree cannot be changed. God's plan and purposes must be accomplished. Now, one other verse in light of that. Numbers chapter 23. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, the fourth book. Numbers 23. Verse 19. Numbers 23, verse 19. God is not a man. Aren't you thankful for that? That he should lie. Neither the Son of Man that he should repent, that he should change his mind. Now remember, we said the king of Babylon was an absolute ruler, that he could make a law and then he could change his mind and make another law. God is an absolute ruler. He can make a law, but he'll never change his mind. Because the law he made in the first place was perfect and right and according to his plan and his will. So there's no way he'll change it. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? He'll make it stand, literally, the Hebrew says. Behold, verse 20, I have received commandment to bless, and he hath blessed. I cannot reverse it. The irreversible, irrevocable word of God. Now, in the context of this, we have this prophet Balaam, and King Balak. What did King Balak want Balaam to do? Remember? Right. He wanted him to curse the Israelites, the Jews. That's what the king wanted. But God blessed them. Remember with Abraham, I will bless your seed. And there's no way that that could be changed. And this crazy king, he thought, well, maybe if you stand in another place, try it here, and maybe God will change. He kept trying to make God change his word, and it never worked. So even though we have this irrevocable decree of the Medes and Persians, it's gone out, God's over all. And it, from a human point of view, it's an impossible situation, really. The odds of getting out of this one are fantastic. The Jewish people, as we're going to see, when they got the news of this, they got that sackcloth out and the ashes, and that was the worst news the nation has probably ever received. And Haman thought he had it made. And the future of the Jews had never seemed so dismal and so black. And it was almost like they just were waiting out the time and let the days pass until that fateful day of destruction should come. Now, I think there's a real lesson here we don't want to miss. Because even in our lives, God may allow you, God may allow me, to get into circumstances and situations that look utterly hopeless. And it seems like there's no way out. It seems like there's no solution. It just seems like total disaster. A hopeless, helpless, dismal situation. And as far as you're concerned, from your human point of view, there's no solution, there's no answer. You don't know what to do. Everything seems to be going the wrong way. And from a human perspective, you can almost see how it's going to come out, a huge disaster. And yet, whenever you're in that place, just remember these Jews. Remember that they were in a situation totally hopeless. They were humanly positive that they were doomed and to be destroyed, except for those Jews that believe God's promise, as we're going to see later. But if they weren't looking Godward, if they didn't have God's perspective, they would have been without hope. They would have seen no light at the end of that tunnel. And yet, we're going to see that God had a way out. God had a solution. Even though this decree would not be changed. It would not be changed. But God had a way to get around it, so to speak. And you know, we're going to learn later, probably our last night, we're going to learn that God has a decree that dooms every one of us to eternal hell. God has issued a decree that, and here's the amazing thing about it, it cannot be changed. And it dooms every one of us to eternal destruction. And that decree was not changed. And yet, some of us are going to heaven. And how did God ever get around that? We're going to see. Maybe you can think, what was that decree that sends every one of us to hell? We're going to get to that. These things look hopeless and helpless, but God has an answer. Now, let's go back to Esther. We have 1 minute left, about. And that will give us a head start on tomorrow's section. Don't forget to read chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Esther. Esther chapter 4. You could read chapter 6 too. We probably won't get there tomorrow, but it wouldn't hurt. Esther chapter 4. Now, let me give you a question. What would you do if suddenly you discovered that you, your parents, your brothers, your sisters, your grandparents, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins, and all your loved ones, your children, and everyone close to you were going to be killed on a certain day in only 11 short months? What would you do? Mike always has an answer, doesn't he? To what? Read your whole Bible? Oh, okay. Okay. You'd quickly evangelize your entire family. Okay. We should, of course, be serious about that now, even though we don't know the day when they'll die. We know it's coming, right? It may not be 11 months, but it's coming. And we want to be the very best testimony we can be, because we don't know how much time there is. It could be less than 11 months, and our loved ones could be gone. Well, look how the Jews reacted. And we'll continue this next time. See, that's what they do with the children. Kevin teaches a missionary story, and he says, and then you come back tomorrow, and we'll finish. Let's have a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we are so thankful that even when things look completely black and hopeless, no solution, no way out, that God is on the throne, that God is sovereign, and that God is able to take all things and work them together for good. All things, even those disastrous things, even those terrible things, and work them together for good to them that love God, to them that have been called according to His purpose. And we thank You that He has predestinated us